the Casahun matter.
Is this the court reserving 3 minutes for a rebuttal?
You tell me what you want, and I'll put it on the clock.
That's fine. Yes, Your Honor, my name is Nelson Berry, and I represent Zeliki Casahun. It is axiomatic that before a court can determine whether there has been a substantial change of circumstances to warrant a support modification, it must first determine the current income of the obligor spouse. As this court found in Marriage of Buckland, without any clear idea of Mr. Buckland's gross income, there was no way to determine whether his circumstances had substantially changed.
So, but here, didn't the trial court say Mr. Casahun hasn't met his burden to show that his income has changed? Isn't that, in effect, what they did?
Well, I suppose the court can read that in there, but I submit that he did. In fact, what we know is that at the time of trial, his income had decreased from a gross of $13,750, which is what the court, the dissolution court, had originally found, and it was, which was changed on remand at $12,750, to a gross of $5,676.08, and a net monthly income of $2,888.18 before payment of any L&I expenses or his support obligations. And in fact, even though the dissolution court had found he's not going to need any more loans to pay his support obligations, the evidence is undisputed that he had to borrow more than $120,000 just to meet his support obligations, and has to continue to have to borrow $1,000 a month to meet his child support obligations. That is a severe economic hardship, as well as a substantial change of circumstances. But let me just finish this point. In fact, Mrs. Ashigari has acknowledged in her brief that if we subtract that $120,000 in loans, which she acknowledges that he had to incur to meet her support obligations, from the total deposits into his personal accounts in the 28 months from December of 2013 to March 2016, that the cash flowing through his accounts was $5,578 a month, and after subtracting for L&I payments, it was $5,293 per month. That's almost exactly what Mr. Casahun reported.
But didn't the trial court reject Mr. Casahun's testimony that he had to borrow this money?
Well, I don't think that's very clear. But it's absolutely clear that he did. And it's undisputed that he did. And the thing is that what makes this particularly galling is that instead of addressing this threshold issue about, well, what is his current gross income, she devotes her opinion into chastising Mr. Casahun for every trifle that shows that he's not living in abject poverty, including the fact that he spent a couple of $100 on his on birthday and Christmas gifts for his children, while at the same time completely ignoring not only the fact that he had to borrow it's undisputed he had to borrow more than $120,000 and has to still borrow $1,000 a month, but also completely ignoring that Ms. Ashigari routinely was taking thousands of dollars in cash out of these payments every month from her account without any accountability for what she did with these monies. Monies that Mr. Casahun had to borrow to pay these inflated and excessive support obligations in the first place. She completely disregarded the fact that Ms. Ashigari was taking thousands of dollars in cash each month.
From her own account or from the business account?
Well, Ms. Ashigari, from the monies that she was receiving in maintenance and child support, those would be paid into her account, and then if you look at those bank records, as soon as that money hits her account, she's taking out thousands of dollars every month in cash, and she never accounted for these funds, and in fact told the court she didn't feel like she had to. It's my money, she said. I don't have to account for it. Now, the point is that what we also have in this case is Ms. Ashigari coming forward and said, well, the court could have done this or could have done that to find what his income was, but those are speculations. The trial court didn't make those findings. But here are some things that we do know as far as substantial change of circumstances. We know that in addition to the court finding that he wasn't have to make any more loans, it's undisputed. He had to borrow more than $120,000 by the time he got to trial, and he was still borrowing, and still to this day has to borrow $1,000 a month to meet his child support obligations. We know that the components that the dissolution court had used to basically fabricate his income, that none of that was happening at the time that we got to the modification trial. He wasn't capable of saving $1,500 a month. He didn't have access to $1,750 in elusive cash. He didn't have all of these things that the dissolution court had fabricated to come up with its income. And the point is that we also, and I've made this point, we know that the trial court was biased in this. She refused to impute income to Ms. Ashigari, even though it's mandatory. It was undisputed she was voluntarily underemployed. In fact, the court wouldn't even include her actual income in her support obligation. Not even her actual income. Which, you know, is a clear abuse of discretion. And the point is, too, is that my client not only provided all of the information that he's statutorily required to do as far as income tax returns and all those things, he also provided all of his bank statements, provided all of his credit card statements, and there was not a single expenditure that he had that was undocumented, in sharp contrast to Ms. Ashigari. We still don't know what happened to the thousands of dollars each month that she was taking out of the account. And the court may say, well, why is that necessary? Well, it goes to her need. It goes to her need. And there's no evidence that shows that Kasun was capable of saving any money or had saved any money. There's no evidence that he had continued access to substantial amounts of cash. What we find as far as him using his business funds to sometimes pay personal expenses is, well, first of all, query, is that should that really be considered income if he has to take money out of his business to meet his support obligations or to meet his living expenses? But even more significantly, what we found, and it's undisputed, once he stopped making those maintenance payments, there was no further expenditures from his business account to make his personal obligations or any other expenditures. One of the items was that my client had been awarded two cabs, taxi cabs, in the dissolution proceeding. The court completely blew off the fact that the court can take judicial notice of the fact, but we actually presented evidence that the taxi industry in this city has collapsed since the advent of Uber and Lyft.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Okay, sorry.
It's up to you. You use it however you want.
No. I'll wait. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Elizabeth Helm for Ms. Ashigari. Mr. Casahoon absolutely did have the burden of proving that there was a substantial change of circumstances to warrant his request that maintenance be eliminated entirely and that the child support be modified. Final orders were entered in this case in November of 2013. Mr. Casahoon filed this action for modification and elimination of his maintenance 8 months later. Like at trial in the dissolution, he claimed during the modification that he was impoverished. That has been his argument all along. He never agreed that or admitted that he earned the $12,750 that the court ultimately determined that it was his income at trial. He argues that the court is required to look only to his wage stubs and his tax returns to verify his income. But what the court found was that his wage stubs and tax returns were not a reliable indicator of his income. He has sole control over how much money he takes from that business and how he reports it. So he can take a very small and modest salary and claim that that is his entire income, but that is within his entire control. He uses this business as a way to launder money and to provide for all of his personal expenses, which are far, far beyond what he claims in his argument.
Let me ask you about the Buckland case. Mm-hmm. Does it require the court, even in rejecting the threshold, to make a finding of what his income actually was, separate and apart from what had been determined before?
I don't think so. I think in the Buckland court, they said they couldn't determine an income because he didn't provide adequate information in his wage stubs and tax returns. And so because they had no information about his income, he had not met his burden to show that there should be a modification. In this case, actually, the court had quite substantial information to determine his income. I don't think the court was required to say, now, based on this evidence, the tax, the bank statements, the credit card statements, the all the personal expenditures that we can see, the checks that he's written off the business to himself and to for his rent and to other personal expenses. I don't think the court was required to say, well, I'm going to add all of these things up and I'm going to come up with another figure on modification and then say, okay, this is now what your income is. I think the court looked at all of that evidence and had that evidence laid out for it, and could see that, in fact, his income was equal or greater than the $12,750 that the trial court found. And therefore, he had not met his burden to show that there was a substantial change of circumstances. Even just looking at his tax returns, even if you just take those at face value, which we really can't, he makes more money now than he did then at trial. Even if you look at the cab income, which we believe is really a red herring because it's quite negligible in the overall accounting of all of his income, he makes more now than he did then. I mean, he claimed at trial that he was making literally less than $1,000 a year on the cabs, reporting that on his tax returns. And then now, at the time of the modification trial, he was claiming that was quite a bit higher. I believe in the first 3 months of 2015, it was like, you know, his net was several thousand. But aside from that, it is not a change of circumstances. The cab industry issue is not a change of circumstances. It was known at the time of trial. There was a testimony that the impact of Uber and Lyft on the cab industry was something that was known about at that time. And at trial, his taxi cab licenses were devalued from what he originally paid for them because of the changes in the industry. So for a multitude of reasons, the cab industry is not an issue. But in terms of the court kind of touching on some of the other issues, unless you have any specific questions.
What about imputation of income?
Yeah, that was what I was going to go to. So the policy, the public policy that's enumerated in case law is that both parties must contribute to child support. And that's why you impute income to a person who's voluntarily underemployed or unemployed. In this case, Ms. Ashigari, one, was purposefully supposed to be unemployed because she was supposed to be given this time to get her education and get herself on her feet so that she could go out and make a livable wage. But even more importantly, and I think the central issue is that she has $5,000 worth of income attributed to her in the child support worksheet. She is accountable for 47% of the child support obligation. She is absolutely paying her fair share of the child support obligation. And you put on top of that the fact that he isn't paying that maintenance. So she's having $5,000 a month attributed to her as income in the child support worksheets, 47% of the total, and she's not even receiving it. So she's paying over her fair share of the child support in this case. And there is no statutory basis or case law basis that would require the court to then pile on top of that $5,000 an additional imputed income that would then take her share of the total child support amount over 50%. It would give her the greater share when she's actually not receiving, and receiving, in fact, a lower child support amount because of the fact that maintenance is included in there.
Is there any case that talks about the relationship between maintenance payments and imputation of income?
Not that I have found specifically, no. The loans are highly disputed. the loans at trial, the trial court determined that the loans were not necessary. In modification, the loans were disputed as being necessary, as being even used for the purposes of payment of maintenance or child support. Mr. Casahoon borrowed, supposedly claims to have borrowed, a substantial amount of money. I believe it was $24,000 that he deposited into his account right before he stopped paying maintenance. So there's no documentation of exactly what he used that $24,000 for, but it certainly wasn't for the maintenance payments. And the court, the court made a huge credibility determination in this case and found that overwhelmingly Mr. Casahoon was not credible in his statements about his income, in his statements about the loans. And given that, and given that we have hard evidence, a substantial amount of evidence that actually shows that his income is far, far greater than what he claims it to be, that he uses his business to write checks to himself, to write checks for his rent and other personal expenses. He uses his credit cards to pay his personal expenses. One of these loans, the Bank of America credit card that he claims was a personal loan, he's paying back with business funds. And paid it back, and all of this money that he's pulling out of the business is in fact income. That is pretty well established by the statute and by the case law, that you have to look beyond the wage stubs and the tax returns to look at all of the income that is received from a sole proprietorship or a S corporation or any kind of small business, that all of that, and in fact, in this case, there really is no distinction between Mr. Casahoon and his business. They are one and the same. He uses them interchangeably, and he uses them to camouflage what his income is. And in this case, I think that the trial court in the modification recognized that that, in fact, was happening just as it happened at the time of trial, and that there was no substantial change of circumstances here to warrant a complete elimination of the maintenance or modification of the maintenance or to warrant a modification of the child support. Ms. Ashigari asked that this court affirm that the trial court's ruling, and also she has asked the court to award attorney's fees.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Opposing counsel's speculations about what she thinks the trial court judge was doing are just that, they're speculations. She doesn't know what the trial court was doing, and the trial judge didn't really say so, except what we see in her decision. So she didn't say all these things that counsel thinks she might have been doing. That's speculation. Mr. Casahoon has, and to the court's point, yes, the court must calculate the person's gross current income. That's what Buckland stands for.
Even when you find that the threshold for the modification is not met.
That is the threshold for the modification. That's what Buckland stands for. That's what State versus Spout stands for. The threshold for the modification is, well, we have to see if there's been a change in the current gross income. As the Spring case says, you know, the issue is, where does this person's ability to pay these obligations? It is the threshold determination. That is the threshold determination. And also, even without a substantial change of circumstances, if you have to go out and borrow $120,000, and you have to borrow $1,000 every month, to pay your child support obligation, which is undisputed, regardless of what counsel says, that's a severe hardship. That's a severe economic hardship. You should not have to borrow money to pay your support obligations.
Can it be imputed if there's maintenance payments that are included in calculating the child support obligation?
Yes. Yes.
Is there a case that says that? Or is it?
Well, the cases that say it is that this is not discretionary, that the court must, it's mandatory, that by statute and by case law under Goodell, for example, that you have to impute income to a spouse who is voluntarily underemployed. In this case, there's no question that she was underemployed. In this case, the court didn't even include her actual income. That's also a violation of the statute that requires that the court base support on income from all sources. The court just gave her a pass. This, I also submit, is proof of the court's prejudice. The point is, I also want to get rid of a few red herrings. Mr. Cosman has never argued that the court is limited to just looking at his wage stubs or tax returns. That's not what the statute says. The statute says if there's proof of other income, it must be provided with sufficient verification through independent records, which we had. His checking statements, his credit card statements, things like this course. If you look at counsel's brief, she comes forth and makes all sorts of accusations. Oh, he's spending thousands of dollars a month doing this and that and the other. No citation to the record. No proof of that in the record. And that's contrary to the evidence presented at trial. You know, Ms. Ashigari concedes that the court in this case had substantial information from which to determine his income. So the court can't guess at it. It has to make this determination. The balance of her argument, what she thinks the trial court could have been doing when she made her decision, is pure speculation because the court didn't do that. We have no evidence that the court did that. With respect to the cabs, she says, oh, well, it's nominal. In 2012, his income was $13,000. Now it's.
Counsel, your time has concluded.
Thank you.
That ends this morning's calendar. We are in recess.
Thank you.
Is in recess.